You're listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business. I'm Austin Meek with WacoBusinessNews.com, and joining me in the KWBU studio today is City Councilmember John Kennard. In District 3, he's responsible for residential neighborhoods like Castle Heights and Brookview, the booming commercial area along Hewitt Drive, and the industrial spaces on Imperial. We talk about what it takes to faithfully represent a body knowing there are so many diverse opinions on what's best, and John shares his tactics on evolving into a well-rounded, multi-sided purveyor of policy. But first, it's the word on the street. My philosophical love affair with Nancy Grayson has been well documented here on Downtown Depot. She owns Lula Jane's and founded the Rappaport Academy, and her two latest moves have done nothing to abate my admiration and respect for this East Waco pioneer. We caught up on the front porch of a new cottage she's developed off Elm Avenue at the corner of Tyler and Preston Streets. The banks of the Brazos are half a mile away, you see views of McLean Stadium in the distance, and neighbors and people from all across the city are coming to peek inside 702 Tyler.
We build them to style. We have crown moldings milled to match the era. This is a very linear house, so even the sidewalk is linear because that's the 1920s and 30s. And so our attempt is to build in a way that complements the houses that are already here, rather than trying to modernize the neighborhood.
Nancy completed cottage number one last year on Dallas Street, built in the style of the 1890s. Cottage two channels the 1920s and 30s, and she hopes to build a number of period-accurate residences.
So they feel, when you go into the cottages, they feel very spacious, and they contribute to the spirit of the history of the neighborhood. That's the goal.
Nancy said the area is special, and she wants to do everything she can to foster friendships between neighbors.
East Waco is charming. East Waco has longtime residents and citizens who care about their neighborhood. It's very community-oriented, very neighborhoody, and we like that. We know all of our neighbors are over here, and it's just conducive to porch sitting with each other.
Nancy also updated me on her proposed cottage development on Elm Avenue that I discussed on Downtown Depot back in May. At the time, she was headed toward a precedent-setting showdown with the zoning board, but she's since changed course.
We had hoped to do a cluster of cottage bed and breakfasts, and there are rules on Elm, which we were reminded of by the city. And I understand rules and the overlay, but it didn't match the layout that we felt would be successful for the cottages as an overnight stay point. And I can't use our money to build in a way the city wants us to build that I felt wouldn't lead to a successful Elm Street project.
There's a publicly declared pocket park on one side of Lula Jane's, and she'll plant trees on the other side to create a park-like setting on Elm.
And so we're really into green space, trees, places for people to gather or wander or have picnics, and this just helps to do more of it, and we're fine with that.
If Nancy had taken this project before the Zoning Board of Adjustments in 2010, she would have dealt with the chairman of the board, John Kennard. John has since moved on to the city council and stopped by the KWBU studio earlier this week to discuss his journey.
Hi, Austin. Thanks for having me on today.
It's a pleasure to have you, John. Thank John you. Wears a lot of hats. He is a city council member. He is the vice president and trust officer and in charge of investment banking there at Community Bank and Trust.
Yes.
But before we get into the things that you're currently working on, I want to hear a little bit of your history and how you ended up here in Waco.
Sure. It's a pleasure for me to be here, and I appreciate it. I like the good work that you're doing and highlighting all of the wonderful things that are happening here locally in Waco.
Thank you.
I came to Waco to go to Baylor actually about 19 years ago this week. As a freshman, you know, BU, I studied classics and history and then some business while I was there. Then after I graduated, I had some friends here and had a job offer at Community Bank, which I've actually been at since before I graduated from Baylor, so 15 years now.
So were you interning there as a student?
I was, yes, doing credit underwriting and that sort of work for the commercial lending side. And so I stayed on full-time after I graduated, and that's how I came to Waco and how I stuck around. And I just grew up before that in the Fort Worth area. So Central Texas, born and raised.
The program that you studied under at Baylor, the University Scholars Program,
yes.
That's the major for people who are too smart for any of the traditional majors. So they're kind of just like, hey, you create your own curriculum, and you chose history and classics and business.
English. And then I transitioned away from the liberal arts because I realized that reading ancient Greek wasn't going to pay the bills. And so then I moved towards more real estate, finance, and accounting and that sort of subjects, and was able to, like I said, land in a finance gig here in town.
What did you write your senior thesis on?
When I was at Baylor, I actually did not have to write a senior thesis.
Oh, wow.
Through the program. At the time, there were no requirements, just a few. Have a few hours of upper level to show progression and something, and beyond that, I could take what I wanted. So no other requirements beyond that. So it really was kind of far-ranging and allowed me to really just explore a broad variety of subjects and topics.
To what do you attribute the liberal arts education in your current success and the way that you look at problems that you face either at the bank or at the city council level?
Well, I think in general, just being able to think critically, analyze, and have that appreciation for what's come before. Reading, everything from Homer to, the Federalist Papers to Southern, fiction literature, Faulkner and all of that, really gives you a kind of a broad perspective of where we are, just in this current point in history globally and also locally. History doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme. And so that perspective of the thought leaders that have come before and the progression of ideas and culture and everything that makes us who we are today, just having an awareness and that knowledge of kind of how those ideas and thoughts have progressed through time it helps.
In doing a little research for this show, I was reading an article in the Waco Trib back in 2012 when you were first coming on to the city council.
Uh-oh, yes.
And what they were mentioning in there is what seems to have become your trademark, which is simply taking a look at all of the information and coming up with a solution based on what's presented there, rather than coming in with a preconceived notion of
right. This
is the way that we do it in Waco, this is how we do it in my district. And it really does seem, I'm not saying that the other city council members are not like this,
sure. But
you in particular have taken a truly analytical approach to the city council positions and in taking every single issue as a separate one rather than this is the policy that's a blanket for everything we do in our city.
Yeah. Yes, I try to come in without any preconceived notions or kind of dogmatic ideals of what I think is best. Obviously, I have opinions, but I think in our, particularly in this politically charged climate that we find ourselves in today, the idea of flip-flopping or changing your mind is sort of seen as a weakness or something to kind of be derided and it just is downright bad. But I pride myself on not having all the answers, on approaching a particular issue with an open mind, allowing my constituents and the information and the data to change my mind if it figures out that my opinions aren't correct. I think that's how you lead. I think that's how things get done and better, and how you can really be responsive and representative of your citizens and bring part of yourself into whatever decision that you're coming to, but understanding that I don't have a corner on what's right, and that being respectful of other people's opinions and trying to find something, that good word compromise is I try to find that in everything. And it's sometimes it's nice and sometimes it can be a curse that I can see both sides of an issue because it can slow down a decision making sometimes. But overall, I think it's served me well over the last few years.
It certainly has. And John, I have to give you credit because not every elected official actually feels that way. Many people will run on a platform of, I'm going to do what's best for the community, and really it's their agenda that's trying to be pushed. This seems like it's something that's pretty central to your core set of beliefs. How did this sense of equality and wanting to hear all of the issues, how did you first get that mentality? Is that something that you grew up with, something that you saw modeled in your home?
I think it's just something that was innate in me. It's funny. I took a personality test what, a good decade ago at Baylor's, the Strengths Finder by Gallup. And some of my biggest strengths were analytical and deliberative and, you know, being responsible. So taking on responsibility, I think, obviously, if all the things I'm involved in, that's something that just comes naturally to me. But also being willing to take the time to evaluate whatever the issue might be, listen to differing opinions, you know, provide reasonable, you know, a forum for reasonable discourse and discussion, and really kind of see what the best way forward kind of percolates up out of that discussion and out of that thought process is. I think that's just something that is just kind of honestly part of my personality, and it's nothing that I really work towards training towards. It's just I just try to do what's most fair, I guess, and equitable.
What do you read? How, like, that worldview of equality is informed by things you read, you study, conversations. Are there any authors or podcasts or resources that sort of train you in that mentality?
Honestly, not really. I mean, I try to, you know, so much of my reading these days is consumed with getting ready for meetings, and a variety of, to find leisure reading can be sort of difficult. But and here recently, my books have actually trended more towards behavioral psychology and why we think the way we do. Daniel Kahneman with Thinking Fast and Slow, and then Richard Thaler with Nudge. Just finding ways that the understanding. You know, it, like you said, those processes for going through that thought process and understanding, kind of bringing the biases that you bring into a situation or a conversation, understanding where my shortcomings are and where my fallacies and thinking might be, and the heuristics and the just the cognitive paradigms that I fall back on to try to make a decision quick, understanding those. You know, how my brain works, how other people's brains work, can kind of help foster new ways of thinking and new ways of doing things. So that's been, there isn't any one particular set of authors or areas of literature that I kind of lean towards. But again, here recently, it's been more of the behavioral psychology things, just to understand why we think the way we do, why we make decisions the way we do, and how we can work towards making better decisions.
And not just investigating, but being honest with your own blind spots, the things, the way that you've raised, the prejudices that you have that are all inherent in us, but calling that, it's simply the way that I was raised, it was a perspective, and it's not necessarily right or wrong, but finding a way to reach that point of equality to serve all of your constituents.
It's always just trying to make yourself better. Yeah.
So before your time on the city council, you were on the Zoning Board of Adjustments.
Yes.
You ended up serving as the chairman of that board.
Yes.
Let's take a current example. For instance, we discussed on Downtown Depot a few episodes ago a proposed development by Nancy Grayson on Elm Avenue for these cottages that she's trying to do. Mm-hmm. And she will be required to go before the Board of Adjustments and request a variance. As someone who is on that board, and we can take this case in particular, or you can talk more generally, but what are things that come into mind as you're sitting there hearing a person requesting a variance? Because you have to balance, I want to do what's good for the community now, and I want to, you know, be beneficial to this person who's working really hard and trying to make something. But also, we have a precedent that we've set with our past rulings, and we have our future to consider. What sort of conversations happen in that meeting? And how do you balance those?
It's kind of interesting. That board, I didn't fully appreciate, the authority that I had. It's one of only two boards that the city council actually doesn't have the authority to go behind and change their decision or have a final say. I mean, what that board decides is what it is. And if you want to change it, you have to go through court. And the interesting thing about that one is what that board's set up to do is when the city council passes a rule, say for all residential lots, you can't have a fence higher than 6 feet. A property owner will say, well, I'd like a variance to that rule and put my fence up 8 feet. That's a simple example, but one you can understand. And so it's that board's decision to decide whether or not in that particular instance there are extenuating circumstances that apply that would allow for a bending of the rules that the council has set in order to in order to let the owner do what you know, that particular lot may back up to a commercial area, or there may just be a potentially problematic neighbor that they're trying to avoid. So you have to kind of weigh all the considerations of why the particular lot and layout and why that particular request is coming. But broadly, what that kind of leans to and why I try to keep a pulse on that board in particular is that if we as a council make a rule that the board doesn't like and people keep coming to it trying to bend the rule to something other than what we've adopted, then that board has the authority technically to do that, which if so, I think we need to reconsider the rule. But that hasn't been the case. Usually it's things – I mean, honestly, the bulk of what we do would be, again, fence heights and, say, carports that were going into a setback line off of a curb. And I don't know what the particular variance is for these cottages that Nancy's doing. But it's one of those things where that board decides whether or not in a particular instance the rules that the city has established for development, if the you know, whether it's lot size or location or there's something about that particular development that merits bending the rules a little bit to allow for something that's not technically allowed under the existing zoning ordinances.
A few weeks ago, the city council heard two proposals for redeveloping yes. Heritage Square downtown, one from Judge Ed Kincaid mm-hmm. and his Heritage Crossing, and another from a group led by Chris McGowan and Philip Williams with the Civic Center. When Chris was talking, he quoted the economist Ray Perryman, who has been featured in the Waco Trib. He does a monthly report for them. But Ray, claims Waco is the next great Texas city. As someone who has been involved in the nitty-gritty of city management for the last 10 years, you know almost more than anybody about what's happening in Waco, the optimistic and pessimistic views of it. How do you take a statement like that, the mantle being placed on Waco of the potential to be Texas's next great city?
I think that we absolutely have the potential, and I think it's going to take a little more work for us to realize that potential. You know, it's people, our proximity to larger population centers that are becoming increasingly expensive, overcrowded, and just not as enjoyable places to be, gives us a unique opportunity, not only with the positive sort of perception that Magnolia's kind of brought to us and the visitors, but also just our not only our geographic, but I think our leadership is in a place, not only at the city, but with the other public entities as well, and private sector, the businesses too. There's more of a collaborative spirit, I think, in our community now than there's been in a long, long time. And I think we all understand and have at least some idea of what the shared vision could be for Waco and are working hard to get there. And so I don't think it's a stretch when that's said. I do know that there's a lot of work that's gone into it to get us to this point and know that there's a lot of work to make that vision fully realized. But I think we're on our way. And I think like developments like the ones that have been that were presented to us that you just mentioned from the Heritage Square, I think that's really great. And I also think that, you know, some of the other developments we've had in the past, you know, staff's done some research and did the interviews and kind of provided a recommendation to us. But in this instance, there were two, you know, qualified, good, presentations, each with their own, you know, each development, each with their own merits that, you know, that were different enough that, brought them both to us for us to kind of consider. And I think that, you know, that public input in that to what they want to see is helpful. I've said myself that I think downtown could use more Class A office space. And I think that would be helpful and kind of engender a lot of the other development that people would like to see if we have that space and if we fill it, particularly with the relocation or the creation of new firms from either outside of town or here organically locally, as opposed to just kind of moving existing folks around. I think that could really be a catalyst to some of the things that we want to see. But it's like I said, it's good to get public input in that, and it was great to see two different presentations to provide two kind of visions of what that area of downtown could be. And I think that's just again another opportunity to spur discussion to kind of see and crystallize and help maybe move the discussion forward in a collective way of what we want our town to be.
You're listening to John Kinnaird here on Downtown Depot on KWBU. John, you just mentioned a collaborative spirit that's here in Waco right now that hasn't been here previously, at least not in your time. To what do you attribute that collaborative spirit and this? I mean, it's not all Magnolia. Like, that explains that there's, you know, 20 or 30,000 people visiting every week,
right.
But a collaboration between downtown business owners and citizens who are finally wanting to come back into the core and experience that. Is there anything that you can pinpoint as the reasons why this collaboration has cropped up within the last few years?
I mean, I think, you know, it's just part of kind of culturally where we are. But also, I mean, I want to give at least some credit to our former mayor, Malcolm Duncan Jr., who kind of spearheaded the Prosper Waco initiative and who really was instrumental in bringing a wide assortment of folks together to work on a variety of issues. And I think it grew beyond him. But I think that was kind of one of the nascent sort of beginnings of that idea that we, private industry, other public entities, school districts, county, the county government, others, we all could come together, that we all could find efficiencies and commonalities and ways that we could, you know, make the community better together and deploy our resources in a more effective way, more scalable way, and things that we might not have thought otherwise if we had just been kind of working on our own. It's kind of funny. We have moved out of our own little silos, as the silos have provided. I just thought of that. I'm probably a little too proud of that.
But I'm bummed.
Thank you very much. But it's as we've moved out of our own silos, and if the silos have provided that positive public perception and kind of changed the story of our community, you know, that has made us a nationwide attraction, and has really kind of displayed a lot of the great things that we really do have to offer that people might not otherwise have been able to, just wouldn't have known. I think that all of that together has helped move the conversation forward. And again, like, there are a lot of good things happening, and when good things are going on, people want to be a part of it, and that just creates a broader sense of commonality and collaborativeness and just, you know, community spirit and moving the ball forward on what we want Waco to really be.
And when you have success, you want to share that success.
Right.
Success is not enjoyable when you wrap it up all on your own and nobody else can access it. So it's been great to see that Magnolia has had tremendous success. There have been other local businesses that have had tremendous success. We as Pokios have had tremendous success because of the generosity of other businesses that allow us to come and park there.
Mm-hmm.
We would be nowhere if we weren't for Dichotomy and Dancing Bear and Barnett's and so many other community partners that we have. That collaborative spirit is evidenced really well in Prosper Waco,
yeah,
in the way that you guys have taken so many of these disparate groups who are all trying to do great and put together the infrastructure for reaching even higher heights with what we can do in developing our community educationally, health-wise, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Well, in Prosper Waco, what I appreciate about them, again, as my number one strength on that personality test was analytical, and, you know, I am a numbers guy and work at a bank and do, you know, investment management for my day job, and so I am very appreciative of a reliance and appreciative and agree on the reliance on data to making sure that the objectives that we come together and identify are actually being met, and that we agree on common metrics to help evaluate and judge and see just how well we're doing on what we are trying to accomplish. That shared vision, not only a shared vision, but with agreed upon outcomes and then a way to actually track whether the progress towards those outcomes, I think kind of helps keep us all in the conversation on track and in the same direction. And again, that collaborativeness, it moves it forward if we all have a shared set of metrics that we're trying to identify and get to and achieve, and also just have that common goal in place. And so that's, I think that broad-based, you know, focus on, like you said, education, health, and financial security, tackling all those issues all at once is, I mean, it's ambitious and it's daunting. But I think that Matt Polk and the others and his staff over there and the board as well, I think they're all doing a phenomenal job. Really identifying things that needs that our community has and finding ways to address them in new and more innovative ways.
And then we have people like Jimmy Dorrell, our guest from two episodes ago, who has created the Jubilee Food Market and now the Reap Urban Farm,
mm-hmm,
getting to that health you have to be healthy if you're going to be able to go in class and be educated. And
right.
if you're not educated, you're not going to be able to have the financial literacy to get out of debt and to get cash flow positive and continue to grow your family.
Right. And that's – well, and, you know, and the things that, that Jimmy's doing, the things that Compassion Ministry does, the things that Talitha Kumb – I mean, you name the nonprofits and other organizations around town that are trying to do good. You know, Prosper Waco, all they do – and, I mean, they do a phenomenal – great job of this – is they identify what other people are already doing and they say, maybe – how can we maybe do this better? What other needs aren't being addressed? How could – you know – three of y'all are, you know, one of the things that I'm working on is the Community Loan Center, which is a nonprofit payday lending alternative that is employer based. And as I've been, so we're trying to get that scaled up and rolled out to more people to help provide an alternative to high cost, small dollar loans that would be accessible others through payday or title lenders. Just maybe somebody, if they can have a job, they can get it through their work to kind of help break that cycle of debt. One of the things I've discussed with looking at getting employers on is other employers already offer either low cost or free loans to their employees, which is fantastic. It's identifying those resources that are already out there that we might not know about and bringing those folks to the table and saying, maybe we could do this better. Maybe we could partner together to reach out to more, figuring out ways that, because I think we all want to do good and we all want to do, you know, what's right and see our community grow and do better. And seeing what you know, someone down the street's doing and say, well, maybe I can help with that. Or maybe if we kind of, you know, the person, you know, further down the street's kind of doing the same thing. So maybe if y'all brought it together, we could scale it up and do something even better with it. That convening and that collaboration, that work, I think is important and can really help us again get to the next level and achieve something that together that we might not be otherwise able to achieve if we were all just kind of doing our own thing.
One thing that's going to help our city get to the next level is the proposed riverfront development mm-hmm. there being developed by Catalyst Urban Group out of Dallas. Heard a lot about the riverfront development months ago. It's gone a little quiet. Can you give us an update on the progress?
I probably need to get a better update myself. I know that the environmental work is progressing, and I know that can take more time than anybody would like it to. But it's one of those things that you want to get done right, that's not cheap to do, but that is necessary not only for the state regulatory body, but also just for the common health of the citizens. And, you know, it's funny to think that, well, not funny, but I mean, after the tornado in 53 and other, you know, events in the past, that the solution to all of that rubble was to just bulldoze it onto the riverfront. And that's where a lot of the environmental remediation is having to – that's what a lot of the stuff we're having to clean up now. It's – to go from that to kind of where we are today in a regulatory sense of how we take care of our – you know, take care of our trash and how we dispose of all of the waste that we create, it's interesting to see how far we've come in just a few decades. It's ongoing, and it's definitely a – you're right. It's – I think the group that's heading up, Catalyst, is right, is a catalyst for downtown, and that we're cleaning up as fast as we can.
John Kennard, District 3 City Council member, thank you so much for coming on Downtown Depot.
Thank you for your time, Austin. I appreciate it.
That's it for this week, but be sure to check out Downtown Depot on Apple Podcasts and the NPR One app to hear previous episodes. Also, be sure to keep an eye on WacoBusinessNews.com next week as I cover the debut of Mission Waco's renewable energy and agriculture project, Urban Reap. You can find Waco Business News on Twitter, Facebook, and now Instagram for updates in between shows. I'm your host, Austin Meek, and you've been listening to Downtown Depot, where we track the ins and outs of Waco business.